I wasn't sure how to do this talk because there's kind of two talks you can give. One is about the whole enchilada, and the other one's about the piece of the enchilada that you're having trouble digesting. And I already talked about whole enchilada 2 years ago, but Terry asked me to be didactic, so we're going to have to do the whole thing again. But in the end of the talk, I'm going to try to move away from outrageous philosophical assertions and onto a couple of mathematical insights that might help us get there for those that are tuned to such things. Okay, so my research goal, and I think it does fit within this project quite well in a way, is to try to connect the theory of probabilistic learning that we have in machine learning that we built up since the days of neural networks and before, with the empirically observed structure of living matter, not with neural networks, but with what's actually happening, seems to be happening in living systems. And if you take time out and look at it, you discover some pretty basic things which are kind of swept under the rug by most of our computational theorizing. And the first observation that you could make is that if you have objects, parts of those objects get summaries of the activities of the parts of other objects. So if this is an object and there's some little objects inside this object, and here's another one over here, the parts of this object are getting summaries of the activity of these guys, right? You're not listening to my spikes, you're hearing my words, right? Neurons do not hear the clatter of the ion channels in other neurons, they hear the spikes. So information goes up to a higher network level and then comes back down again. That's the basic point. And so there is a name for at least one of these things. The name that we use in complex systems theory or whatever, for something emerging from microscopic degrees of freedom to produce an effect at a macroscopic level, the name for that is emergence. But I think there's a sister term that you could use for the information that goes down from a higher network level to a lower network level, and the natural one to use after thinking about it for a while is submergence, because it's got mergence in it, and it's going in the opposite direction. I tried to make up words like advergence, but nobody liked them. So that's what I call it. So I think that this emergence and these submergence are the two key things that are happening in living systems. And the most amazing thing about them is that they are missing in horizontal theories, right? These interactions are not horizontal. That means that, neurons do not talk to neurons. People do not talk to people. People talk to each other's neurons. Neurons talk to the synapses of neurons. And if you look at all the different levels, you see that pattern repeating all the way up and all the way down. And so I always like to draw a little, every time you see a box, it means there's a vector with some numbers in it, right? And if there's some name beside it, that's the notation for it. So I imagine like things moving forward in time, and you have some microscopic state vector, some macroscopic state vector. This could be my words, this could be my spikes, these could be my spike timings, these could be the positions and conformations of all the proteins in my cells. And and of course, these microscopic vectors are big, the macroscopic vectors are small. There's a dotted arrow, which means that all the information in the macroscopic vector is in the microscopic vector, but not vice versa. Information is lost as you go up the hierarchy. And in time, you're getting causal influences, which are both upward and downward. And we don't mean anything mystical about this downward causality. We just mean that the stuff up here is the adequate information to describe the causal influence on the things that it's talking to at the lower level. What that means is a spike is, at least in certain models, a spike is the adequate information which one cell is sending to another cell. You don't need to specify, the motions of all the proteins in cell A to know what cell B is hearing. So that's what we mean by this downward arrow. It means that this information is well summarized. And so you're not actually having downward causation. It's not some mystical thing. So I want to zip through a bunch of examples of this and show what happens when you look at the nervous system this way. This is a hippocampal stain for a shank protein, which is in the postsynaptic density. And so you can see all these synapses. So I just put it up there because I learned from Terry that it's good to show a picture of a nice neuron. And it really shows that these little things, they're little, these are distinct punctate protein complexes. These are the synapses on the spines of a hippocampal neuron. And these are what neurons are talking to. They're not talking to the neuron, right? They're talking to all these little spots, right? And similarly, when you go down and look at these synapses, here we've got two of them from our Berkeley color electron micrograph machine. Two synapses are sitting beside each other, and this is the postsynaptic density. What do you think is happening in this postsynaptic density? What is it hearing about what's happening in this postsynaptic density? Well, a vesicle fuses, some ions come in because the proteins in here change their conformation. You get an EPSP, you maybe get a little calcium bump. And what is felt over here, if I can use that term, is this little bump. These guys don't know the motions of these proteins, but each one of these proteins may be doing something different with that information. So you're having the same pattern repeated here as we move down one scale. The neurons are talking to synapses. The synapses are not talking to synapses horizontally, even though they're right beside each other, right? The synapses are talking to each other's proteins. So an EPSP coming in here is talking to the molecules here, and when these molecules produce an EPSP, the same thing, vice versa. So even the interaction through this tiny little piece of cytoplasm in a dendrite is of this form, upward and downward. And so I put in slow world and fast world because we had that earlier on. This is, as you go further up, things go faster. As you go further down, things go slower. I mean, the other way around, actually. Just flip the bit on that sentence, flip the sign. So these are two examples of submergence from neurons to synapse, submergence from synapses to macromolecules via spikes and via EPSPs. In both cases, into much bigger storage spaces than what you start with. There's 1,000 times as many synapses as neurons. So mapping from neurons to synapses is 1,000 times over complete. How many macromolecules are there per synapse? I don't know, maybe Dan could answer that one.
Lots.
Okay, and so it continues. Calcium is playing a role inside the synapse, which is possibly like that played by voltage in the cell as a whole. There are local microdomains, according to Morgan Sheng, on the order of 10 to 20 nanometers, roughly the width of an NMDA receptor. Calcium is varying within this little postsynaptic city in a meaningful way, and the proteins are communicating with each other. And it takes a little bit of argumentation to make the same argument for protein-to-protein communication, but you can do it, right? Proteins which are nearby each other, they have got detailed energy landscapes, but they don't feel every little ripple of each other's energy landscape. They just hear very like roughened out versions of it, smoothed out versions. They just see the general conformational states of their neighboring proteins. So even within this, you have a submergence and emergence properties like what I've already described. And if you keep on, I just want to say that some synaptic plasticity researchers are coming to terms with, I think, with this concept after years of arguing with each other about what's the magic switch in LTP and whether it's pre or post. Some people are writing articles that saying, well, it's like all these molecules are involved in it. It's a huge, big, you know, all the voltage-dependent channels, many, many voltage-dependent channels, gap junctions, whole range of molecules involved in plasticity. So you're really mapping your experience down through your spikes into this big space of little things. So that plasticity is ubiquitous and memory storage has to be thought of more as some kind of systemic mapping between some higher network and some massively complex lower network, as opposed to, you know, the Hebb rule, the thing that we're looking for. So we can just put it in the computer and forget about, you know, the physics and the physiology. And so you go further down and look at, you can't do an electron micrograph of the cytoplasm, but you can calculate how far away things are and draw a picture, which is what these guys did. These are ribosomes, these are proteins, and this is RNA. And that's how much water there is between these guys, you know? Some people estimate between four to eight water molecules, current estimates, as low as four water molecules between proteins. And this particular picture, which is from 10 years ago, this is the edge of a protein here, and these are small molecules like metabolite, things like that, amino acids of various kinds. You can see there's maybe four water molecules between these guys, but there's more than four water molecules between proteins. But it's a very tightly packed space, and this water is pretty organized. If you look at the energy landscapes of water, it couples to the energy landscapes of proteins, and the water forms clusters that can be quite big, that last for several picoseconds, and that's kind of like the right length of time to couple up with the time constants of how things are moving around in the proteins. And so you have essentially a network of macromolecules interacting with each other through a water network, and the hydrogen bonds are forming and unforming in the water all the time, and that creates a medium for communication between molecules. It's not that you get down there and you're suddenly in some thermal regime and there's something called heat, otherwise known as noise, which is completely unordered and just wipes everything out and shields even more microscopic physics from being of functional relevance. That's almost certainly not the case, in my opinion. So we've already had about 10 minutes. There's lots of argument about that, like quantum physics and things like that, but you have to think, if we can amplify, and Barlow showed in 1972 that a retinal ganglion cell can fire a single spike in response to a single photon. So as you go through the retina, you can amplify a quantum event into something of behavioral relevance. If that's possible in the retina, it's probably possible all through all biological tissue to amplify the extremely small, microscopic, down to your baseline physics, amplify those events through the hierarchy of the order of the matter to produce effects at microscopic scales. It's probably what's happening. So I want to jump back up to a level that some of you may be more comfortable with, which is the level of cell assemblies. I don't know if you're aroused or relaxed or sleepy or whatever, but here's some oscillations. These are the most important thing that you see in the brain, probably. One of the first things to be seen, and one of the biggest clues, I think. And if you start to look at these oscillations, as some people have done, well, this kind of stuff's been going on for a while, and Walter Freeman's talked about these things for many years, but one of the principles that has been emerging recently is, you're familiar with the notion of synchrony in oscillations, where synchronized gamma can create something synchronized gamma network can create something which makes an idea, it hasn't been proven, but synchronized gamma network perform a computation that then is passed on through the thalamus, maybe up to a theta oscillation, and comes out to affect your behavior. I ask you, what's the capital of France? It goes down to a gamma oscillation somewhere and comes back up, and you say Paris, right? So you could think of memory retrieval as going down through this network of oscillators of different frequencies, where the low-frequency oscillators, like delta-type oscillators, are doing full-brain reset, or maybe 10 centimeters. Theta networks may be operating over 3 or 4 centimeters. Gamma networks operating locally in cortical tissue over maybe 1 millimeter or a third of a millimeter. And so what they've discovered, and this, I don't want to go through these three slides because this is really three studies condensed into something that you can't even read, but look at the middle one. This is from a longer talk. The middle one is a human electrocorticogram done in Berkeley by Bob Knight's lab, a guy called Ryan Connolly. They got the data from UCSF. They're taking the human EEG, one electrode on the surface of cortex, and taking all the theta, bandpassing at theta, and then lining up the signal and looking at its power spectrum. So you bandpass at theta, line everything up. You bandpass at theta, you do the Hilbert transform, work out work out how all the theta oscillations line up, and then plot the power over all the frequencies. And they discover that the theta oscillation, at a particular phase of the theta oscillation, the amplitude goes right up or right down, right up or right down, all the way from like 20 hertz up to 200 hertz. So you have phase amplitude coupling between theta oscillations and all the way through the beta and the gamma spectrum, all the way up to what they call super gamma, because usually gamma only runs to 100 hertz. So this is so you're really looking at like something happening here, which is a space-time. Sorry, if I do that, I'll be all over the place. A space-time pattern in the theta range, which is saying which space-time patterns in gamma can happen. Right? If at a certain phase of theta, you're more likely to have the gamma amplitude going up, then you're kind of like gating the gamma networks by your theta oscillator. That's the argument. The same thing Lakatos has shown in A1 auditory cortex occurring between delta networks and theta networks. And Pascal Friis's basic argument about the interaction between spike timing and gamma is that the same thing is happening between gamma gating, which phase you are on the gamma oscillation determines whether or not a spike can actually be effective, whether or not a spike can get through, because it's whether or not you're near a threshold. So you have this hierarchy of dynamical mechanisms going down from, you know, the low cognitive frequencies, like what we have when we're talking, dum da dum da dum da dum, all the way up to the high sort of non-cognitive or more computational frequencies, gamma, all the way to spikes. So I'm arguing that it's the same thing in these networks, which are more transient, of course, than cells and organisms, but these assemblies are forming and unforming, and there's submergence and emergence occurring in this way through the oscillatory hierarchy. That's just summarizing. Global low-frequency oscillations index into more local higher-frequency oscillations. That is, they set up space-time patterns that allow only certain more local patterns to occur. And then the retrieval is the result of the more local computation, which is passed back up to the more global networks. So my claim is that the adaptive power of living systems comes from this gating of information flows across levels, and that no horizontal models have this power. In other words, if you just sit down and you say, I'm going to build a neural network with n neurons, and you ignore the fact that information is coming up from the microscopic, from the molecular, you're not going to capture this, right? If you think, how are memories stored and retrieved? What I'm arguing is that if you don't actually think about the mappings between the spaces involved and acknowledge the fact that they are computational significance, you're not going to be able to actually capture the enchilada. This is the enchilada, right? Maybe it is lunchtime. So, you know, how are actions or decisions generated? What is the mechanism of learning? What happens when a thought comes into your head when you think of something? You know, now Jerry Swartz was always trying to get me to think about, not about consciousness, but about the emergence into consciousness. Like, not about the thing in itself, but what happens when something occurs to you. Something emerging into consciousness is something percolating up from microscopic coherence to microscopic networks. That would seem to me to be the logical way to think about the physiological correlate of something popping into your head. So I don't mean to be that rude about horizontal models, because I worked on them all my life and everybody else does as well. I think they're really great for fleshing out the rungs of the ladder. We wouldn't have this picture if we hadn't built them. But we'll never get a picture of how things move up and down the ladder if we stick to them. So, to summarize, emergence is an undercomplete mapping into a lower dimensional space for the purpose of sending messages in a more macroscopic network. Submergence is an overcomplete mapping into a higher dimensional space for the purpose of sending messages in a more microscopic network. And I think this picture of the storage and retrieval roles of the microscopic is a fundamental challenge to computational and effective physical theories. Effective physical theory is a theory that, you know, oh, it works. You know, it's got some error term, but we don't have to worry about that. It works well enough. Well, the error term in the emergence point of view is exactly the information which is the violation of your model, which is working at one level, is exactly the information which is driving the whole thing, which is, you know, not the way you like to think of it. If you think about, you know, you build your model and it doesn't quite fit the data, so there's an error term. Well, the error term is the real thing, right? That's the idea. It's the thought occurring to you. So I think these horizontal interactions only occur in anomalies like the computer and other models in which emergence from the microscopic is screened out. And here's a computer. Actually, I had to put this arrow in because I realized that there was submergence in the computer. Like, in principle, you could imagine if there was some really, you know, conspiratorial electrons down here that after running if then a bit too many times, they get stuck and cause a crash in the program, right? You could imagine that happening. It probably doesn't happen, but you can imagine that the bit description could configure the electrons in such a way the bits can configure the electrons in some way as long as that never gets up, right? So the thing in the computer is that it's not supposed to have emergence. It can have submergence, but it can't have emergence. You can't have the electrons getting together and deciding to make the if into an and, right? So that doesn't happen in a computer. But biology, where you look at spikes and proteins, it's happening all the time. So these levels, I should say, are determined by the principle of minimal adequate description, which sounds very fancy, but all it means is we put things up here if they are the minimal descriptions that give you a causally adequate description of the causal effects on these guys. And that's very important because a lot of the argumentation follows from that. So looking more closely at what these things are, so you can see information can go all the way down, all the way up, and it can be going down and up and up and down and up and down. Sometimes you fall asleep, and it just hangs right out here. Words never get out your mouth when you're asleep, but the neurons and the molecules all talk to each other. So there are gatings. There are important gatings of this information that occur even on our 24-hour cycle, right? Information flows are cut off and reformed again. And when you switch from alpha oscillation, when you're like daydreaming or thinking about an equation or something, that's different from your theta-gamma coupling, which is when you're trying to say something or when you're trying to understand what somebody's saying. So looking inside these boxes, the higher information, each interaction in this whole big sort of lattice of levels moving forward in time, right, takes the form of the outside of an object interacting with the inside to create some local space-time level state, right? So this could be, for example, the state on the membrane of a neuron, right? And this could be the spikes arriving from other neurons. So, and then what's down here is the state of this neuron, but in more detail, right? This could be maybe the state of a synapse. This could be the positions of all the molecules within the synapse. And this could be the timings of the spikes coming into the synapse. So that little triangle, that gives you an example of, you know, of a synapse as an integrator of microscopic molecular information and macroscopic neural network spiking information. That's an example of what I mean there. And how much longer should I go, Gary? Probably I'm nearly done.
All right. You've got minus 4 minutes.
Minus 4 minutes. Well, that's really bad because we didn't get to the part of the enchilada that I couldn't digest yet.
Maybe save that for initiative 4.
Okay. We could do that. I have some.
There will also be an advertisement for all of you who want to hear more to come tomorrow to the mission.
So I'm trying to connect this stuff to Infomax and probabilistic models that connect to deterministic transformations of information. And I have like 3 slides on that, which has got some equations in it. So that wouldn't be a fun way to end the talk. Well, the taste of my partially digested enchilada. Delightful.
So maybe just what's the problem? Just state the problem.
The problem is how do we get to grips with this theoretically? And the answer, I think, is through linking causality to probabilistic models. That means every time you see something cause something else, then you put a little probabilistic model there, right? You do, as Gary would say, you say, how likely was that, right? Your dynamics, your computation is continually, how likely was that, how likely was that, how likely was that? And you like add all these things together in a way which I can't actually, haven't actually completely worked out, but I've got about two-thirds of it. I think I've got about two-thirds of it. You can never tell with these things. And you get an equation for how likely is everything, which is pretty likely, actually.
How likely is lunch?
And this equation here is really, really interesting and important. And it's a second-order equation in the weights, and it's model-free. And that's what you get if you have a system which doesn't have input, but is just trying to self-density estimate itself and moving forward in time. You can write a second-order learning equation in time for the thing which doesn't refer to any of these models. Almost all the problems we have in machine learning are problems to do with model selection, partition function gradients, all kinds of nasty things like that. But when you do this kind of how likely was that thing in time, all of those things disappear when you differentiate the objective function. When you differentiate the objective function, not just with respect to the weights, but also with respect to time, you get this second order thing. And I think that's important. I'd love to talk to Javier and other people about that. So I'll finish with the implications. Single level models can't capture inter-level information flows and thus can't explain memory, thought, perception, or action. Horizontal theories are essential, but wrong. There is no cutoff level, but rather submergence all the way down and emergence all the way up. So there's no computational level, there's no thermal level. Agent-centered theories with concepts like reward and fitness are wrong because behaviors are just mesoscale emergences. The behaviors of organisms are just things that are happening in the middle of this network of networks. And so I can see that, and this is an argument I've had with Rich before, and I'd love to have it again. And sometimes I state myself too strongly, but I think that when you think about the self-organization of organisms in a room or in a community, there are many things that are making you do things, not just things to do with yourself. There are things that are making you do things that are to do with your cells, right? There are things that are making you do, like, have lunch. There are things that are making you do things to do with the community, your family, or whatever. So there are all these forces operating from all these different scales on you. And so I think that just to think about reward centered on an individual agent is too impoverished a framework to come to grips with this empirically observed multi-scale structure. That's what I mean. Maybe that's a better way than I've said it before. Uncertainty in a model should never be confused with noise in the system. This is the most common mistake I've observed in science, maybe, I think. The latter is a completely undefined concept. One man's signal is another man's noise, and vice versa. So just because you make a model and it has some error term, you should never think of that error term as being noise in the system. You should never think of channel noise as noise. You should never think of spike timing, as being a point, as being like some kind of noisy process. You should never think of vesicle release in synapses as being a noisy process, because from the point of view of the local proteins, it's entirely determined and has a computational role in gating the flows of spikes from one neuron to another. Those are what I think are implications of this way of thinking. Prospects. Progress towards mathematically rigorous, concrete, implemented example models of adaptive emergence and submergence that could get you grants. I didn't say that. Has been frustratingly slow, though with some flashes of insight. Many of the things I said here, I said 2 years ago. I'm frustrated by how slowly this is going. But there's been some progress, and the payoff is big. If we can work out this kind of thing, I think, we're really in business.
One of the more minor consequences of what you said you know, going back to your diagram of computers, which only have the submergence and no emergence,
yes.
is that computers will never be conscious.
Well, it depends where you think consciousness actually is, right? Does it end in at your skin? Does it end at your spinal cord?
But you do need emergence. I mean, that's what your theory is telling us, I think.
I think computers are part of consciousness. Think of a computer. Think about what computers are being used for mostly today. They're like the synapses of if people are neurons, computers are like the synapses between people. They are things which are creating collective effects in the internet and politics and everything like that that are hugely part of our consciousness. So they are little machines that are part of the consciousness that we experience. What we experience is not just our individual, but also, you know, collective things like, you know, the elections and all that kind of stuff, right? So I think that we have to rethink the way you say that, right? They are part of the conscious thing that is happening, but they're set up as little machines to behave in very reliable ways, and there may be other things like that are fairly like that in biology. You know, there may be cases where, you know, things are screened off. When you sleep, you are gating information between social network and the neural network. So there are definite cases biologically where there are these cutoffs, but they're appearing and disappearing according to, you know, requirements.